Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. New York, this is Democracy Now!
Of course, it will escalate the situation. The fascists in Israel are dragging the region into a whole explosion. In 24 hours, they attacked in Lebanon, they attacked in Tehran. What do they want? To drag the region into a total explosion. And this is what Netanyahu wants. He knows that the end of this war is the end of his political career.
Fears of a broader regional war in the Middle East are growing as Hamas and Iran accuse Israel of assassinating Hamas's top political leader, Ismail Haniyeh, while he was in Tehran for the inauguration of Iran's new president. Haniyeh was killed just hours after Israel claimed it assassinated a senior Hezbollah commander in Beirut. We'll go to Beirut, Tel Aviv, and Boston for the latest. Then Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris dares Donald Trump to debate her.
As the saying goes, if you got something to say,
we'll speak to law professor Kimberly Crenshaw of the African American Policy Forum about Harris's historic campaign, racist Republican attacks, and much more. All that and more coming in. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Iran's government has accused Israel of assassinating senior Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh in a missile strike near Tehran, raising fears of a broader regional war in the Middle East. According to Iranian media reports, Haniyeh was killed along with his bodyguard when a guided missile slammed into a residence north of the Iranian capital where he was staying for the inauguration of the Iranian president, Masoud Pezeshkian. Before his assassination, Haniyeh played a central role in talks to exchange hostages and to negotiate a ceasefire with Israel. Israeli officials have not yet confirmed any involvement in Haniyeh's killing. However, the Israeli government press office posted a photo to Facebook of Haniyeh with the word "eliminated" over his face. The office later took down the photo. Iran's supreme leader condemned the assassination and promised, quote, harsh punishment against Israel in a statement read on Iranian state television.
The supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khomeini, emphasized the criminal and terrorist Zionist regime with this action has paved the way for severe punishment for itself, and we consider it our duty to avenge the blood of he who was martyred in the land of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Hamas said Ismail Haniyeh's funeral will be held in Tehran on Thursday morning before his body is transferred to Doha, Qatar for burial on Friday. The killing of Haniyeh came less than 24 hours after Israel claimed it had assassinated Fuad Shukr, a senior Hezbollah commander in Beirut. The strike killed three civilians, including a woman, a girl, and a boy, and wounded 74 others. Hezbollah confirmed Shukr had been in the building at the time, but the group has not confirmed his fate. Israel had accused Shukr of being involved in Sunday's rocket attack that killed 12 Druze children in the occupied Golan Heights. Palestinian rescue workers in the Gaza Strip have collected dozens of bodies from the ruins of Khan Yunis after Israeli forces devastated the city during an eight-day ground assault. Health officials report the invasion killed 255 people and wounded more than 300 others. Dozens more remain missing. Meanwhile, the United Nations Human Rights Office warns in a new report Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails face widespread torture, sexual violence, and brutal treatment. The UN found at least 53 Palestinian detainees have died in Israeli custody since October 7th. Others face torture, including waterboarding, sleep deprivation, starvation, electric shock, and the release of dogs. The UN says most of the Palestinian men, women, children, doctors, journalists, and human rights defenders jailed by Israel are being held without charge or trial in deplorable conditions. In Washington, D.C., dozens of interfaith activists Tuesday disrupted a gathering on Capitol Hill by members of the lobby group Christians United for Israel, or CUFA, one of the largest pro-Israel organizations in the United States with some 11 million members. The group's annual summit largely focuses on advocating for increased U.S. military support for Israel. Activists blocked a bus transporting CUFA members from National Harbor in Maryland to Capitol Hill. Meanwhile, in a separate action, several activists took to the water in kayaks at National Harbor, just outside the hotel and conference site where CUFA members gathered. Protesters held a 28-foot banner that read, "CUFA kills," and Palestinian flags, as activists also denounced CUFA's ties to white nationalism. The government of France has formally recognized Morocco's claims of sovereignty over the northwest African territory of Western Sahara. The decision announced by French President Emmanuel Macron on Tuesday is a major victory for the Moroccan king, Mohammed, and a setback to Western Sahara's indigenous people, the Sahrawi, who fought for decades to organize a UN-backed referendum on independence. Morocco's occupied Western Sahara since 1975 in defiance of the United Nations and international law. Over the past four decades, thousands of Sahrawi activists have been tortured, imprisoned, killed, or disappeared while resisting the Moroccan occupation. Ukraine's Air Force says it's repelled a major Russian drone attack, describing it as one of the largest aerial assaults in months. Officials in Kyiv say it was the seventh Russian attack on Ukraine's capital city this month alone. The Biden administration's pledged $500 million in new military aid to the government of the Philippines as the U.S. and its allies in the Asia-Pacific continue to ratchet up tensions with China. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin announced the deal after meeting in Manila with Philippines leader Ferdinand Marcos Jr. at the presidential palace. Outside their talks, protesters burned a U.S. flag and condemned the military agreement.
We believe it will further the military intervention of the U.S. in the Philippines. It will lead to intensified basing of the U.S. in the Philippines. It will heighten tension in the region. The U.S. is putting forward an agenda that is contrary to our stand for peace and freedom in our country.
Nearly 1,000 children died while being forced to attend U.S. federal government boarding schools that sought to exterminate Native American identity, language, and culture. Those were the final findings of a groundbreaking report published Tuesday by the Interior Department, which for the first time in its history accounts for the U.S. government's role in the gruesome assimilation practices enforced at the schools. The report, which calls for a formal apology from the federal government, was commissioned by the first indigenous U.S. cabinet member, Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, whose grandparents were forced to attend boarding school starting at the age of 8.
Very cabinet agency created to assimilate indigenous peoples released a historic investigative report detailing the impact, trauma, and damage caused by federal Indian boarding schools from 1819 through the 1970s. This trauma is not new to indigenous people. One of the reasons I launched the Federal Indian Boarding School Initiative was to ensure that this important story was told, that all of America knows of the intergenerational impacts of these policies, and that we, as a nation, take steps to heal from them.
In Illinois, pressure's mounting for Sangamon County Sheriff Jack Campbell to resign over the fatal police shooting of 36-year-old Sonia Massey. Her family joined civil rights attorney Ben Crump in Chicago Tuesday to demand justice after a local police union announced it would not continue to challenge the firing of former Deputy Sean Grayson, who's also been charged with first-degree murder for killing Massey. The police union had previously represented Grayson and tried to get him reinstated. Crump spoke Tuesday as he called for police reform legislation in Massey's name.
We must continue to say her name. Sonia Massey.
Sonia Massey.
Because black women who are killed by police officers in the United States of America rarely get justice.
Meanwhile, CNN reports a newly surfaced audio recording reveals Officer Grayson was previously reprimanded another agency for filing an inaccurate report about a traffic stop in pursuit, with a superior officer warning Grayson that his report could have amounted to official misconduct and that he had lied. Prisoners in Florida, the largest federal prison complex in the United States, say they launched a hunger strike on Sunday to demand external intervention to address health and safety violations, abuse of power by guards, and denied visits. A man incarcerated at the Coleman Satellite Low Camp told Democracy Now 30 people were moved to solitary confinement in response to the hunger strike and said they've since paused the protest. This comes as the Department of Justice investigation of Coleman led to more than a dozen arrests last week, including corrections officers charged with smuggling in drugs. Vice President and Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris rallied thousands of supporters in Atlanta, Georgia, Tuesday, where she defended her support for harsher immigration and border enforcement policies. Harris compared her record to Donald Trump's and blamed the Republican presidential nominee for tanking a bipartisan bill that would have further militarized the southern border.
Our administration worked on the most significant border security bill in decades. Some of the most conservative Republicans in Washington, D.C. supported the bill. Even the Border Patrol endorsed it. It was all set to pass. But at the last minute, Trump directed his allies in the Senate to vote it down.
Harris has touted the recent endorsements of more than a dozen mayors in Arizona, a border state, including that of Republican John Giles of Mesa, who praised Harris's backing of the failed bipartisan bill, which immigration advocates say would have further eroded the rights of asylum seekers. And members of the National Association of Black Journalists are protesting their organization's decision to invite Donald Trump to the stage when the NABJ holds its annual convention and career fair in Chicago today. On Tuesday, Washington Post editor Karen Attia stepped down as co-chair of the NABJ's convention, citing its decision to have Trump interviewed at the forum. He's being interviewed by three NABJ journalists. Bobby Henry, the chair of the National Newspaper Publishers Association, which represents over 250 African-American-owned newspapers and media companies, condemned the NABJ's invitation to Trump, writing, quote, "His divisive rhetoric and actions have harmed marginalized communities, particularly the Black community. Allowing Trump a platform at this event undermines the NABJ's values of inclusion and solidarity and risks normalizing his damaging behavior," he said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Coming up, fears of a broader regional war in the Middle East are growing after Hamas's top political leader, Ismail Haniyeh, was assassinated in Tehran just hours after Israel claimed it assassinated a senior Hezbollah commander in Beirut. Stay with us. So Wish, a Sufi poem by Hazrat Zaheen, sung by Abida Parveen. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Fears of a broader regional war in the Middle East are growing after Hamas's top political leader, Ismail Haniyeh, was assassinated in Tehran, where he was visiting for the inauguration of Iran's new president. Iran and Hamas both accused Israel of killing Haniyeh. In a statement, Hamas's military wing said his assassination was a, quote, significant and dangerous event that shifts the battle to new dimensions and will have major repercussions across the entire region, unquote. The killing of Haniyeh came less than 24 hours after Israel claimed it had assassinated Fuad Shukr, a senior Hezbollah commander in Beirut, Lebanon. Hezbollah confirmed Shukr had been in the building at the time, but the group has not confirmed his fate. Israel had accused Shukr of being involved in Saturday's rocket attack that killed 12 Druze children in the occupied Golan Heights. Hezbollah has denied involvement. The Lebanese health ministry said Israel's strike in Beirut on Tuesday killed 3 civilians, including a woman, a girl, and a boy, and wounded 74 others. While Israel quickly confirmed its role in the Beirut attack, the Israeli government has not yet made any official comment on its involvement in the assassination of Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran. However, the Israeli government press office did post a photo of Haniyeh to Facebook with the word eliminated over his head. The office later took down the photo. Speaking in Ramallah, longtime Palestinian politician Dr. Mustafa Barghouti warned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is trying to spark a broader war.
The Israeli crime of assassinating Ismail Haniyeh, the leader of Hamas, will not break the Palestinian resistance or the Palestinian people's determination to achieve our freedom. But fascists are now dominating the Israeli government, and they are trying to drag the whole region into a total explosion. Netanyahu is a war criminal, and he is trying even to drag the United States itself into a confrontation with Iran and with the whole region.
There are protests in a number of cities in the West Bank right now, and a general strike called. A funeral for Ismail Haniyeh will be held in Tehran on Thursday. He'll be buried then in Qatar on Friday. Haniyeh had served as Hamas's top political leader since 2017 and briefly served as Palestine's prime minister after Hamas won elections that the U.S. supported in 2006. Haniyeh was born in the Shati refugee camp near Gaza City. Over the past 10 months, Israel's killed numerous members of his family, including 3 of his sons, at least 2 of his grandchildren, his sister and her family. Haniyeh had played a central role in the ceasefire hostage negotiations. Earlier today, Qatar's prime minister, Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani, wrote on X, quote, "How can mediation succeed when one party assassinates the negotiator on the other side? Peace needs serious partners and a global stance against the disregard for human life," he said. We're joined now by 3 guests. Karim Makdisi is in Beirut, Lebanon. He's a professor of international politics at the American University of Beirut, co-host of the Makdisi Street podcast. In Tel Aviv, Israel, Gideon Levy is an award-winning Israeli author and journalist, columnist for the newspaper Haaretz, and a member of the Haaretz editorial board. And in Boston, we're joined by Rami Khoury, Palestinian-American journalist, a senior public policy fellow at the American University of Beirut. He's also a non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center, Washington. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Karim Makdisi, want to start with you in Beirut. You have this reported assassination of a leading Hezbollah commander that takes place in your city, the capital of Lebanon, Beirut, followed by, within 24 hours, the assassination of Hamas's top political leader, Ismail Haniyeh. Can you talk about the significance of this?
Yes, thank you, Amy. It's obviously extremely significant, and people here are extremely worried about, you know, this, what everybody's been talking about, which is this escalation, what seems to be this, you know, inexorable escalation towards a much bigger regional war. And I think it's fairly clear that there are some on the Israeli side, Netanyahu and his fundamentalist, kind of religious fundamentalist government that's there, that really are the only people that have this major interest to continue this kind of war rather than to stop it. And the way to stop all of this war is to reach a ceasefire in Gaza, to stop the genocide, and to ensure that there could be some kind of at least stability in the region. Only one player, only one side refuses that, and that's Netanyahu and his government.
And Karim Atizi, this for decades now, Israel has pursued this policy of assassinating leaders of the Palestinian resistance or other opponents to Israeli policy. Yet it has had no impact on changing the fundamental issue still of the rights of the Palestinian people. What is your sense of how this this policy of assassinations, what it's done to any possibilities of further peace talks?
Yeah, I think on the one hand, it's very clear that, that these assassinations have been successful. I mean, in operational terms, these are very, very important people. But on the kind of larger level, this is a political momentum. There is a people that wants its liberation, that wants its self-determination, and in Palestine anyway, and that will continue to do so even as various, you know, top leaders are assassinated. When one is assassinated, we've seen over the many decades where Israeli assassinations of kind of top-level Palestinian leaders, they're replaced and more so, and they become more and more effective over time. And that's because they represent a people that wants its liberation, that wants its self-determination. And in the case of Lebanon, it's a similar thing. There's an occupation, there's been a very long history of Israeli aggression and attacks and invasions and occupations in Lebanon. And Hezbollah and other resistance forces were created as a result of all these occupations and invasions. So assassinating is extremely harmful for sure on operational levels. But when it comes to the larger struggles, it's not going to stop this momentum towards a kind of, you know, continuing the struggle against Israel, for sure.
I'd like to bring in Gideon Levy, the Israeli journalist, to if you could comment on the current situation, these latest assassinations by Israel.
Yes, domestically, I mean, Israelis like these kind of operations, and therefore those operations are taking place. Here we are again, the James Bonds of the Middle East, knowing the color of the underwears of each terrorist in Tehran or in Damascus. But by the end of the day, I think most of the Israelis understand, I hope they do understand, that this leads us nowhere. Tonight, after those two assassinations, it's very clear that the chances for a ceasefire and for a deal and for saving the hostages is almost finished. Nobody is going to negotiate with Israel when Israel is killing, murdering the negotiators. It's the most basic thing. And above all, history had to teach us by now that all the assassinations that Israel committed, and I stress it, all of them, did not contribute anything, neither to the security of Israel, no to any kind of chances for peace. We had one after the other assassinating, you know, the most horrible leaders. They always told us so much blood on their hands. And then came the replacement with much more blood on his hands.
Gideon Levy, do you agree with Dr. Mustafa Barghouti in Ramallah that Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, is simply trying to continue and expand the war because when it ends, he's out?
Absolutely. But I give him more credit than this. I think it's not his only consideration. No doubt that this is a major consideration because the facts on the ground prove it. He, until now, did anything possible to sabotage any kind of chance for a ceasefire. But by the end of the day, knowing Netanyahu for many years, this man never believed in any kind of deals with the Arabs. He doesn't believe in any kind of negotiation, in any kind of peace with them, and even not with Hamas over a ceasefire and releasing hostages. So by the end of the day, it's a combination of ideology, quite a dangerous and dark one, and personal motivation, sure.
I'd like to bring in Rami Khoury, who's in Boston, a Palestinian journalist. The attack that occurred, which Israel claims was done by Hezbollah on the Golan Heights, on the Druze children that were killed there, very little attention is focused on the Golan Heights. Could you talk about the relationship there between the population on the Golan Heights and the Israeli authorities? Because Netanyahu and others who went there did not exactly receive a warm welcome from those who they claimed they were trying to defend.
Well, nobody who occupies another people is ever going to get a warm welcome anywhere. The Druze are a minority that are originated in the mountains of Lebanon. You find Druze communities in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Palestine. The Druze on the Golan Heights are Syrian citizens. When the Israel occupied the Golan in 67 and annexed it in, I think, 1981, a few Druze took Israeli citizenship. Many Druze left, went back into Syria, unoccupied Syria, and many stayed there but did not take Israeli citizenship. So it's a mixed combination. There are the Druze in Israel have been assimilated pretty much into Israel since 1948, and they serve in the border police and the things like that, the armed forces sometimes. So it's a community that is very much part of the Arab world, but has a different religion and ethnicity in a way. But this is typical of the Arab region, a very pluralistic region, which, of course, Zionism in 1917 convinced the British to create a super ethnic Jewish, super nationalist apartheid state, which has now become a zombie killing machine all over the region. And the world doesn't quite know what to do with it. The Druze are simply the latest victims of this monster that has been unleashed. And really, the lessons, I think, of the last few days, but certainly the last 9 months and more, if you look at Gaza, the West Bank, the whole nature of Israel, the process of Zionism, has to now be contained and defined. And this has to be done by the world, like the world created Israel in the 1947 UN General Assembly resolution. Only the world can step in and contain and define Zionism, allowing the Palestinians to have their right to self-determination, which even now the American leadership speaks of self-determination, two states. They say these things, but they keep giving Israel the arms. So this is a very complex balance between global support for Israel giving Israel carte blanche to destroy international law, destroy UN resolutions, all the norms of civilization. This has been going on for years and years, and it's getting much worse. And this week is an example of two more dimensions of this.
As Netanyahu spoke in the Golan Heights, a crowd of Druze protesters gathered chanting, "Bibi is a murderer," holding up signs calling the Israeli leader a war criminal.
"He is an unwelcome person in our place. He is a liar and corrupt. He is coming to use the bodies of our children to be on TV. We will not allow this to happen."
Gideon Levy, you were there on Sunday. If you can further elaborate on what Rami is saying, talk about how people felt at the time. Now, Hezbollah is saying they think it's a anti-missile projectile, a projectile of Israel that came down on the soccer field, on the children, and killed 12 people. But explain what people are saying, the Druze population on the ground.
You see, I've been there, Amy, really few hours after it happened, and the main sentiment was of shock. People were really shocked. It's a small village, and everyone is attached to everyone, and they all felt that it was their own children being killed. Not only this, they all rushed to the football field, to the soccer field, and they all saw the bodies which couldn't be identified. So the whole village was in turmoil when I was there. Few young people that I talked with asked for revenge, but say that they don't want innocent people to be killed. Others were courageous enough to say, don't take revenge. It will not help us. It will not return our children to us. And please don't do anything, which is very rare to hear in Israel, in Jewish Israel. Usually after attacks over Jewish Israel, the overall sentiment is of taking revenge.